The Public Affairs Department of KCST-TV presents Eyewitness Faces, a weekly recorded television news conference. And now here's your host, Ron Fortner.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of Eyewitness Faces. Occasionally, we suspend the normal parameters of this program to include newsmakers of extraordinary importance. The panorama of security and curiosity surrounding our guest today is part of his extraordinary importance. The ubiquitous Secret Service is here to protect. The equally ubiquitous Washington Press Corps is here, possibly to dissect. And we are here to get to know better the personality and politics of the Republican vice presidential candidate, the Senator from Kansas, the Honorable Robert Dole. Welcome to San Diego.
Thank you very much, Ron.
We'll begin our conversation in just a moment. We are to spend a half hour now with one of the most newsworthy, if not one of the most familiar faces in America today, the Honorable Robert Dole, Senator from Kansas, the GOP vice presidential candidate. Welcome to San Diego. Again, we apologize for the lack of sunshine. Perhaps our hospitality can somehow assuage that. In characterizing your role in the campaign so far, one term, perhaps more than any other, keeps recurring: hatchet man. The GOP strategy appears to be let Mr. Ford remain presidential in the White House while you function as some sort of street fighter going for Jimmy Carter's jugular vein, if and when it ever is exposed. How do you work up any sort of enthusiasm for that sort of abrasive role?
Well, I don't really know. I think I was characterized as the hatchet man before I ever said a word. And it's amazing how the press can tab someone as quiet, wild, hatchet-like, slashing, meek, before they ever utter a sound. And I simply walked on that morning and the president said, "This is the man." And the headlines and the commentators were saying, "Here comes that hatchet man." And I'm willing to accept that characterization if I demonstrate that that's my role, but I don't think that's happened yet. Some of the press has indicated that I've been a tabby cat instead of a fighter.
Time magazine referred to you, I think, as a self-description as the lead dog in the campaign, ferreting out the issues, and essentially
right.
You have been dealing with the hardball routine.
I've been the only dog, so I think the lead dog and the only dog.
Which essentially is also a double-edged sword, which can be a blessing as well as a curse, because you are regarded by many as playing perhaps the most significant role of any vice presidential candidate since Lyndon Johnson ran with John Kennedy back in 1960. Does that augur well with your sense of order?
Well, I think we've handled it not perfectly. We've had staffing problems and getting started, but the president, the Congress is still in session. The president has great responsibilities in Washington. I have been in 25 or 26 states. We've been trying to get around the country, talk about the qualities of President Ford, and very honestly talk about the lack of qualifications of Governor Carter. Now, that may set well with some and not so well with others.
Rosalynn Carter, Jimmy's distaff, says you are in fact a hatchet man, that you are out to try to penetrate the thickness of Carter's skin. How are you doing so far?
Well, I think his skin is not too hard to penetrate, but I think he's sort of doing a self-destruct job on himself. He likes to be interviewed, apparently, and some of the interviews leave me speechless. In fact, there are some I won't even comment on.
In that regard, Jimmy Carter appeared to expose not only his jugular, but perhaps more vulnerable parts of his anatomy in that earthy interview with Playboy magazine. But for a hatchet man, you seem surprisingly reluctant to go to the attack. Is that perhaps because you share essentially the views that Governor Carter espoused with Playboy?
No, I just have said that I wouldn't have been interviewed by Playboy. That's a judgment he made. And I've said beyond that, I wouldn't touch that interview with a 10-foot pole. If he's in trouble, let him extricate himself. I'm not going to throw him a rope.
If you are, essentially, a political expedient, a hatchet man,
right,
isn't the implication implicit that your credentials as a campaigner don't necessarily qualify you to be vice president?
If that were true, I would accept that. But I've had 16 years' experience in the Congress. I've been in the House 8 years, the Senate 8 years, was a state legislator, a county official. I think I've had experience. I've had experience somewhat limited in foreign affairs, but a great deal of domestic experience. I'm a member of the Budget Committee, a member of the Tax Writing Finance Committee in the Senate, of the Agriculture Committee, of the Nutrition Committee. So we think we've had rather a broad range of experience. I was one of the, leading advocates of doing something in Southeast Asia to get out of South Vietnam. So we've had a rather active role. In addition, I was chairman of the Republican Party for a couple of years, which gave me contacts throughout the country. So if I look at on that basis, I think I'm qualified.
You're also a good personal friend of Jerry Ford's for 16 years.
Yes. That,
that couldn't have hurt at all.
No, I never really thought I would be on the ticket, to be very honest about it. I thought it would be Senator Baker. I felt that way when I went to Kansas City. Even though there was some remote chance, I was called, like several others were, to leave my records at the White House, and I did that dutifully, thinking, well, it'd at least be nice back home to think that I was considered. And I was very surprised. I felt that there was some remote possibility, but I was really surprised when it happened.
Some of those records the Ford people ask you to turn over have not been made public as yet, specifically those records that relate to your health, which ordinarily raises speculation that your physical health might be some sort of liability. Can you assuage that fear?
Right, because they have been released on Thursday of this week, and we gave them the unvarnished facts. We gave them just as a doctor handed to me a great... the EKG, the electrocardiogram, 26 different blood tests. I had to blow on something. We gave them the air test, the lung test, plus I have had a lot of difficulty. I've had a lot of operations, a lot of surgery, lost a kidney. All that's in the report. And so we think now the New York Times, the Washington Post will be satisfied, hopefully. I'm in good health, too, by the way. I want to leave that impression. Nothing wrong except some injuries I had in the war.
Would you imply, Senator, that the New York Times and the Washington Post are difficult to please, especially with politicians of your conservative stripe?
I think that would be a fair statement. They're impossible to please, not difficult.
In 1972, Senator Edmund Muskie's notorious crying jag,
right,
for all practical purposes, gave the kiss of death to his presidential ambitions. And yet, within a matter of hours after Mr. Ford selected you to be his running mate,
right,
you were overcome by emotion,
right,
in a Kansas rally, unable to continue speaking. Have times changed so significantly in 4 years that the sort of charge of emotional instability that ended at Muskie's presidential hopes at that point no longer come forth to plague you in any sort of similar provocation?
Well, I think the circumstances were different. I think his is a result of, and it was, I think, a very honest emotional experience he had, but because of very sharp, undeserved criticism that he had. Mine was based on going back to my hometown and a sort of a sense of euphoria. A great thing had happened in my hometown. I was coming home as a candidate for vice president, and I saw in that audience faces that had helped me in the war, raised money for operations I had after getting out of, during World War II. And my father had passed away last December. Just a whole lot of things in addition to a general fatigue and excitement. So I hope it wasn't a minus, but but it happened. I couldn't control it. And for 30 seconds, I was a little embarrassed, but the people in Russell understand it. That's home, so.
Do you think that all other Americans who are not so closely and so compassionately related to you understand a man who would sit in such awesome places of power with his finger on the nuclear button, losing control, even for just 30 seconds? Do you think the rest of America would probably understand where that's all coming from?
I think probably if you turn it around and where I was subject to intense scrutiny and criticism and pressures and then buckled, in that frame, I think there'd be some doubt. But I think it's one of sort of a happiness, a sort of letting go. I sort of feel that people should let go occasionally. Just seems to me that that's a part of life, and the people who never have an argument or never really have any emotional feeling are missing something. And I think from the standpoint of your own well-being, I don't say it's good for you, but it's a normal thing.
Those conservative folks in Kansas obviously like Bob Dole. They've sent him to Washington for almost two decades now. But I'm wondering if the folks back in Kansas properly understand the fact that you are not necessarily, by stripe or by definition, an exclusively conservative political animal.
I think they understand. I mean, I went to Congress in 1961 very conservative, probably too much so as I look back on it, maybe because of a great friendship with my predecessor, who was very conservative, Congressman Wint Smith, been in Congress 14 years. But you sort of change. Now, whether I've changed the better, I guess the people would judge. But you do move a little. I think you have to have some movement. You can't just stay locked into some position forever.
The fact that you were fairly recently divorced and have now remarried and have taken yourself out of that notorious reputation of being one of Washington's most eligible bachelors has had apparently little impact in this election year, in which matters of morality are becoming increasingly sensitive. Your lovely wife is obviously an asset on the campaign trail, are you bothered by any lingering stigma that divorce used to be anathema for public figures?
No, I don't really think of it that way. It was almost 4 years. In the meantime, my first wife had remarried long before I had any interest in that. And so I think it happens. I think it's regrettable. I used to think it was in our case, it was probably a mutual understanding, and misunderstanding too. It hasn't had any impact, and my wife Elizabeth is a great asset on the campaign trail, a member of the board of trustees at Duke, a Harvard Law graduate, member of the Federal Trade Commission, a Southerner. She's our Southern strategy. She's an outstanding speaker in her own right.
If not matters of morality, then surely the issue of religion continues to persist in this campaign. The Gallup poll released this week indicates that nearly 50 million adult Americans have shared a similar religious conversion experience that Jimmy Carter lays claim to. How do you stand in that regard? Are you, by any definition, a born-again Christian?
I don't know how you judge that. I haven't had that experience that he talks about or that others have talked about. I've been in one time in my life, when I was wounded and lying in a battlefield over in Italy, I think I felt almost the sting of death, because I had this fleeting experience of, you know, when you're in that position, you think about the past and the fleeting experience, your mother and your father and people you loved and were close to, and from that standpoint, I've been at that end. I'm not certain what happened, what else happened at that time, but I was rather seriously wounded, and somebody came along and helped me out.
There are no atheists in the bunkers, it would appear.
I don't think so. I think not at that time.
A couple of disturbing revelations surfaced from Washington this week that threatened to become major campaign issues. First, the disclosure that the Watergate special prosecutor, Mr. Charles Ruffin, had subpoenaed records that seemed to suggest that Mr. Ford was being investigated for possible campaign improprieties dating back to 1964. And secondly, that Mr. Ford may have received either gifts or gratuities from U.S. Steel and its chief lobbyist. What's the substance of those charges, as you are aware of their import, and why are they being raised now?
I don't know. It's almost inconceivable to me that here was a man who was probably the most thoroughly scrutinized man who's ever been in politics. They had literally hundreds of agents climbing around, and he went through extensive hearings in the House and the Senate. And then to have the special prosecutor, who's a Democrat, by the way, raise questions. He's also raised some about me, which you'll probably be coming to. At this time, just seems to me that it smacks of something. I haven't decided what, but if you can't have a friend in politics, if you say, and if you must take an oath that I'll never have a friend if you elect me to public office, I'll never let somebody buy my dinner or take me golfing, and we're going back and imposing retroactively some new standard of morality, in President Ford's case, to 1964, I think they may have gone too far. It seems to me the American people, they want honesty and integrity, but they want some standard. They don't want some arbitrary standard. Somebody raising a charge, and then it just sort of sits there. It doesn't disappear. And it just the timing was almost too good. It came on the heels of Governor Carter's goof about taxes. It came on the heels of that interview with Playboy. And the timing was almost too good to be accidental.
You followed the logical progression of my thought, and within the past month, a lobbyist for the Gulf Oil Company claimed and then later retracted the claim that he had given you a $2,000 campaign donation back in 1970. That same lobbyist, Claude Weil, Jr., also charged that he had given your administrative assistants $5,000 to $6,000 for your 1974 campaign, a charge which he apparently has yet to retract. Is it true?
Well, I think you better answer the last one first, because he never made that charge. That was someone who was quoting one of the probers. New York Times been working on this night and day, and the Washington Post, obviously. They're quoting some probers. Obviously, if anything came out of it, it may have been a plant, it may have been a rumor, it may have been a leak from Mr. Ruff or some of the special prosecutors. Mr. Weil has not said that. We don't know what his testimony was. I know what mine was. I went to the grand jury voluntarily, not subpoenaed, offered all my records, and fully cooperated. As far as I knew and as far as I know now, I'm not a target of any investigation. But again, I think it's a disservice to have somebody pounce on something and then have it repeated and repeated and repeated, as the New York Times has done and as the Washington Post has done and as CBS has done, without any substance.
If there is an exposed jugular in this campaign, I would imagine it would be Jimmy Carter's tax reform plan, and I'm sure you would agree with that. On his plan, you suggested that he was ignorant about what constituted the median income in this country, and yet just this week, you apparently misspoke yourself in a South Dakota speech in which you claimed that the median income for a graduating senior was around $19,000. What's all the confusion about what is median income in America today?
Well, yeah, I think the big goof is, of course, Carter's statement. It wasn't mine. In the AP interview where he says that if you have above the median income, you ought to pay higher taxes. And that he didn't think, his second goof was, he didn't think people wanted their taxes lowered. And the third goof was that he thought we ought to pay the same tax on all income. All income ought to be treated the same. Now, what we were suggesting in North Dakota, and did suggest it properly, was that the median income for somebody who's graduated from college in a family, if you consider the wife and the husband, is about $19,000. We're trying to make a point with college students that he's looking at everyone in this class who's going to graduate, get married, and have a family, because you're above the $14,000 level, which is the median income. We didn't misspeak ourselves. He apparently didn't know what the median income was in America. And so Mondale goes up to Maine the next day and said, well, we meant $50,000. Well, it's just not realistic. It is a major goof in the campaign. It's much like 72 when McGovern made the statement about everybody getting $1,000. I think perhaps that and his other interviews, he's had an interview in Reader's Digest, which has a great impact in the Midwest, where he said one of the causes of inflation was excessive, and he used the word excessive, grain sales to Russia. Now, he's been out in the Midwest telling these farmers that he wouldn't have any embargoes on grain. It just doesn't, you know, it's not consistent.
A recent poll commissioned by the Carter people shows Mr. Ford trailing Carter by 5 points here in California. Your appearance today in San Diego and your appearances last week in San Francisco seem to suggest that the president's people do not obviously agree with that poll, or at best are not willing to concede California to Jimmy Carter.
No, we're really not. This is a key state. We're counting on Governor Reagan and others and we're going to do the best we can. The president is, and I'll do what I can, and I don't have any illusions that I'm going to turn anything around as the running mate, but I have been in San Francisco. We are, and have been in San Diego and Los Angeles, and we'll be back in California many times. We think that if you took a poll as of today, it'd even be closer than the 5%. There's movement, in other words, all over the country.
Do you think you're going to do any appreciable good in making that movement upward as far as GOP fortunes are concerned by making appearances such as this?
Well, I would hope so. That's sort of the purpose of it.
A gratuitous question at best, I might add.
I mean, I assume the president's hoping the same thing. He hasn't called me back. And I think we've done some good. We've gone through, in 30 days, we've been in 26 states, put a staff together, gone through the normal staffing problems you have. We're on the right track. We've had, and I'm not boasting, I'm just saying that we've had good responses from the audience. We're trying to get some enthusiasm in the party, and I think we've done that in many places.
But isn't the basic strategy going to have to be altered or perhaps delivered on time, that Mr. Ford is going to have to come out of the White House? Eventually, he is going to have to begin the more mundane task of getting around this country and bound
to
the heart.
He really loves that. That's the, as you know, and you've interviewed him, he really loves the campaign. He likes people. He's a very genuine article. And, of course, he's on the trail this weekend in the South. But he's anxious to go. But I think, again, the American people, the press may not may want him out of the White House, but the American people, by and large, want him to stay there and be president. They can tolerate me running around the country and Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale, but they want the president to be the president. We don't make big decisions. We just make big speeches, and Carter makes big promises, and Mondale makes big goofs. He referred the other day, said, we've got to elect Jimmy Ford. And you know, I'll probably make one myself, but I want to point that up as he was either thinking ahead, I think he was, to November 2nd, or he may be on a first-name basis with Jimmy, but he doesn't know his last name.
Unity has not exactly been the hallmark of the Republican Party, and in a New York appearance with Vice President Rockefeller.
That was a great day.
Wasn't that a great day? There was a theater of the absurd gesture for everybody, it would appear.
Yes.
That the dissension was evident when Rocky declared that you and Mr. Ford are not wedded to the Republican platform. You were later quoted as saying, unity doesn't mean unanimity. Do you support, then, unequivocally, the GOP platform as it was written, without reservation?
Oh, I support it. I was on the platform committee. I was in some of those meetings till 2 in the morning. And as I said in the kindest way I could, unity does not mean unanimity. That means that Vice President Rockefeller doesn't have to agree. But we're on the ticket. Bob Dole and President Ford are on the ticket. We're running on that platform. That doesn't mean if I'd have been able to write it, I wouldn't have changed it. And President Ford probably would have changed it. Governor Reagan would have changed it. It's really the product of the delegates in that convention, as contrasted with the Carter platform, which was written by his aides in closed meetings, and ours were wide open, fully accessible to the press. Theirs was written in closed meetings by the Carter forces. We have a good platform, a good conservative document, and as Governor Reagan said last week in a televised speech, people ought to take a look at the two platforms, if they're Democrats, Republicans, or Independents.
And hypothesis. If you had been president instead of Gerald Ford, would you have granted a pardon to Richard Nixon? And would you have granted that pardon in the same time reference that Mr. Ford granted it?
Well, I said at the time, and I wasn't president, I was running for re-election, that I felt it was premature. Just impossible to look back that far without going back and studying all the facts. As I look at it now, I think President Ford made the right choice. President Nixon paid a very high price. The country paid a high price, too. But it seems to me that as far as healing the country and pulling it back together, we would have still been in that divisive trial, impeachment or whatever. Whatever would have happened, it could have still been going on. The trial could have been going on, and it would have been paraded back and forth. And I think the American people would have been sickened by it all. And I think, in retrospect, he did the right thing.
Carter claims that millions of Americans have simply lost faith in our government because of what he calls, adroitly, the Nixon-Ford years. Do you find the basic trust in our political institutions and the people who govern damaged beyond repair? And what should give you any sort of credence as one whose watch care spanned those deteriorating years?
Well, I think there's been some damage. I've been in politics long enough to know, but I really, you know, I sort of use the young people as a barometer. I'm a Republican. 4 or 5 years ago, you wouldn't set foot on a campus, a Republican, not many Republicans would, unless you were running against the Vietnam War or against an administration. But we've had great responses from young people. President Ford has some great attraction. They really like President Ford. They trust him. And I agree with Governor Carter. There's a lot of mistrust in this country, but it's not all because of Watergate. What he fails to tell the American people is we've had 22 straight years of Democratic, liberal Democratic majorities in the Congress, and they've passed spending bill after spending bill. They've literally bankrupt the nation, and that brings about a little distrust, too.
Senator Dole, thank you for spending the time with us, which is altogether too quickly evaporated. We appreciate you taking time to visit with us today.
Thank you. I can't believe it's gone so quickly.
Hasn't it amazingly passed with great, great pleasure as well. I'll be back with a final comment after this. For very pleasantly destroying the myth that Senator Dole devours the live offspring of broadcast journalists, and for spending a very informative half hour with us, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Robert Dole, GOP vice presidential candidate. I'm Ron Fortner. Good afternoon.